punctual around here. I want to remind the audience the Senate rules do apply, so if you have a cell phone, if you can please mute it. We won't have it ringing during the testimony. We'll begin this morning in subcommittee. I want to remind people to, if you come to the front, please use the microphone and be sure and fill out a witness form. On the first bill we'll hear this morning and on both bills, we will allot a half-hour pro, half-hour opposition on each piece of legislation. If you do not get the opportunity to testify, you can do written testimony, and it will be distributed to the committee. So we're trying to be as fair as possible on getting information to the committee, and that's probably the best way. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, today we will begin with SJR 25, Senator Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, my name is Jane Cunningham, and I represent the good citizens of the 7th Senatorial District in St. Louis County. But today, I really feel like I am representing many Missourians, Missourians around this state who care about the sovereignty of this state, who care about liberty as an American citizen, and who care about their personal health care choices. Many of them are in this hearing room today. Some are in the hearing room adjoining us, and some are watching this live stream with their computers in the hallways and throughout the state of Missouri. So I appreciate them coming. I appreciate their interest, and I also appreciate those who have voluntarily given of their time to allow folks to have live streaming of this hearing. I watched the State of the Union message last night, and as many of you did, and President Obama made it very clear that he wanted Congress to move ahead and strongly urged them to move ahead with his health care proposals, even though he fully admitted that they were very unpopular. Now, that really doesn't matter here. We need to move ahead with HJR 25 no matter what kind of maneuvering continues in Washington, D.C. It is probably past time that we protect our citizens so that they can have their own health care freedoms. Now, SJR 25, the Health Care Freedom Act will preserve and protect your right and my right as a Missouri citizen to make our own medical and insurance choices. As the proposal states, no person, employer, or health care provider shall be compelled to participate in a health care system ordered by the government. It would protect the rights of Missourians to pay directly for medical services without fines or imprisonment to the individuals or employers. It's hard to comprehend in America that we actually have to protect our rights to use our own money that we worked for to pay for a product or a service that we want. But right now, this is having to protect you even from imprisonment, and so that is included in here. It would also prohibit Missouri families and employers from being penalized for not purchasing the government-approved health insurance. Single-payer systems, like in Canada, make it illegal for citizens to go outside of the government health care plan and contract for their own medical services. But the Health Care Freedom Act would make this fundamental dictate unconstitutional. American citizens have the right, it seems strange that I'm having to say these words, American citizens should have the right to make their own health care choices. When government controls those dollars, government makes decisions that are good for government, not for patients. Now, I believe it's important to have health insurance coverage, but not government-mandated health care coverage. In the state of Massachusetts, we've found that having a mandate, like they do there, has created ineffective, bureaucratic, and a costly system. Because of all the mandates, the health care insurance there, the premiums have gone up 40%, and in the ER, they are still increasing with the number of people coming into the ER that are non-payers. Currently, one of the proposals before the federal government in the House version would levy a new payroll tax, P penalty of up to 8% on small businesses if they don't purchase the government-determined plan. But the Health Care Freedom Act would strike at the heart of individual and employer mandates that is illustrated that do not work from the state of Massachusetts. In this economy, surely we know that we cannot put any more burdensome requirements on small businesses or fine anyone for not purchasing a product. It would put employers out of business, and the jobs and the revenue that we so desperately need would continue to disappear. The Health Care Freedom Act will not attempt to block implementation of the federal law as long as that federal law does not require an individual or an employer mandate or forbid someone from using their own money to purchase medical services. The Health Care Freedom Act that we're proposing does not preclude citizens from voluntarily joining the proposed federal public plan or the National Health Insurance Exchange. Contrary to some articles that have been published, this is not an opt-out program. This is an expand your choices. You can continue to enjoy the services that you have chosen now, or you can choose to go with the federal plan if they come down with one. So this would not eliminate any option, only increase options. Again, all this is a simple affirmation of your right, not government's right, to make your own health care choices. Another misunderstanding. Some are saying that we'll lose funds for Medicaid and other safety net programs. The Missouri Health Care Freedom Act, with the language mainly in Section 4, the act will not affect existing safety net programs like Medicare or Medicaid or any of the funding connected with it. Arizona has exactly the same language as our bill, and they checked with their Medicaid agency to ensure that safety net programs would not be impacted. Arizona Medicaid ruled that Medicaid would not be affected in any way by the language that we have exactly in our bill. In short, Missourians will lose absolutely nothing if this amendment were to pass. It would simply codify your current rights into our state constitution. The really strong statement that 33 states in this country are doing exactly what we are doing in this room. It's already passed Arizona. It will be on the Arizona ballot in November, and it's my hope that this committee will pass this through and that this entire legislature will send this to the vote of the Missourians so that we can have the same choice as the Arizona people have. Thank you.
Questions for the sponsor? Just for my clarification, Senator, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution defines the roles of the federal government. Anything not defined there is the role of states. What authority does the federal government have to issue this mandate down upon the states? Are they using in the Constitution?
I don't think they have the constitutional right to do it at all, but I have brought a constitutional attorney with me, and he can answer those questions when it's his turn,
Up. So, questions? Okay. Senator Days.
Yeah, thank you. Senator, what percent of increases do we currently have in our insurance as an average right now? We don't have any kind of program right now that you're talking about, but we do have increases.
Well.
What kind of increases? My microphone's on.
Is it? Mine is, yeah. Too. It doesn't sound like they're working, does it?
Okay, let me do it like this then. I need to know what is the average current percentage increase in insurance premiums that we do have right now. Can you give me that number?
I do not know that. I do know that our work comp has gone down. I do not know when health
insurance.
Well, I
mean, I'm talking about the premiums that the people will pay. Everybody who has insurance. I have not been aware of any of their premiums going down. Can you tell me an average of what the increase is on those premiums?
You mean previously, historically?
Sure.
I don't know that.
Okay. You mentioned a couple of times of imprisonment.
Yes.
For not, I guess, getting insurance Are you suggesting that individuals will be imprisoned if they don't do that?
That is
can you? Can you? I need a specific reference to that in that
piece
of bill.
It's in the House bill, and I will get that for you.
Okay. And right now, the federal government is dealing with the House bill or the Senate bill.
We don't know. I mean, we'll just have to see what they're going to do. Last night, the president urged them to move forward. I don't know what will go.
So we don't know what bill. We don't know what bill we're talking about in the federal government. But that's irrelevant. And then the last question, I think you mentioned in Canada that the individuals are penalized for going outside the system. I also need a specific reference and your information as to where that came from as well.
Yeah, we'll get that. They have to use the single-payer system in Canada. They can't go outside. Now, they may be able to come outside of the country and do that.
No, but they can't come out of the – you're telling me that they can't go outside of their system in Canada for anything. That's what you're saying.
In Canada. But my understanding is, and I will check on this, that some of them may be coming to America for service.
No, I mean in Canada.
Okay.
That's my question. In Canada, you cannot go outside of their
system
for anything.
Medical services.
Any medical service. I just want to make sure I have it correct. Thank
you. I'll get it for you.
Okay, Senator Lager.
And maybe this is a question for your constitutional lawyer, but there's always the great debate about if the federal government passes something, does it preempt what we do here? And so you or whoever can speak to that. That would be helpful.
Well, the federal government, under the clause that your chair mentioned, has certain provisions that they can do, but the states can go beyond that to give more rights to the states. It's just like when the Bill of Rights were passed, and some didn't think we needed the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment and whatever, but we did that, and now we enjoy those. This is really doing the very same thing at the state level, which we have the right to do. It's not too different than the Federal ID Act that we passed last time that nullified, really, what the feds were requiring. In fact, our chairman carried that bill. And Dave Rowland may be able to expand on that some.
Senator Schumer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. So I'm trying to, if there's, say there had been a public option put in legislation, how would that have affected Missourians' ability to participate in a public option? Not at all? Or would it say, you know, if the public option was mandated, then they wouldn't have participated in a public option? Or how, I'm just curious on how it would work.
As I said in the presentation, it would not affect that at all. If you wanted to choose the public option, you would have the right to under this legislation. Or if you wanted to stay with what you have, you would have the right to keep that or choose any of those options that you want.
Thank you.
Not an opt-out.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Did you have some witnesses that you wanted to present?
I do have some witnesses. My first one is Dave Rowland. Dave is a constitutional attorney with the Show Me Institute, and he has also been with the Institute for Justice in Washington, D.C., knows these issues very well.
Thank you, Senator Cunningham, and thank you to all the senators on the committee this morning for allowing me to come and speak. As she said, my name is Dave Rowland. My background is I'm a constitutional attorney. I spent several years in Washington, D.C. working with a group called the Institute for Justice, and their goal is to try and protect constitutional liberties nationwide. So I had the opportunity to litigate federal and state constitutional issues in federal and state courts across the country before coming here. Today I'd like to address some of the constitutional issues that surround the general questions that we're dealing with today. We had a question a little bit earlier about the federal health care bill and whether Congress has the authority to impose the kind of individual health insurance mandate that has been discussed and indeed is a linchpin for the bill. Actually, before I do that, I want to clarify a little bit more about what I believe my role is here today. My goal is to offer as unbiased a perspective as I can, and so I hope to be able to address all of the questions that you have, even when those might not be the way that I think they should be resolved by the courts. There will be times where the courts will do something other than I think they should do, and I'm going to try and acknowledge that and point that out. So I hope you'll be able to trust that I'm trying to be as unbiased as I can in what I have to say. So the current bill has been discussed as being authorized under the Commerce Clause. Congress has granted the authority to regulate commerce between foreign nations, Indian tribes, and the states. And the Commerce Clause has been used frequently to achieve many objectives that Congress has, some of which don't seem to mesh with the traditional idea of commerce, but nonetheless courts have upheld many of Congress's laws. There has been recognition that there are limits to what Congress can do under the Commerce Clause. In 1995, there was a case involving a federal Guns in Schools Act where Congress had tried to prevent people from carrying guns within a certain distance of a school. The Supreme Court said that Congress did not have the right to pass this law because the subject matter of the legislation was not sufficiently related to interstate commerce. Similarly, in 2000, there was a case called U.S. versus Morrison, where the court again said that dealt with it created a federal cause of action for victims of gender-based violence to bring lawsuits against their assaulters. And when the Supreme Court evaluated that law, they said, again, Congress, you have not shown that there's a sufficient connection between gender-based violence and interstate commerce to justify your authority under the Commerce Clause. That being said, in 2005, there was a case that dealt with the use of medical marijuana in California. And the question in front of the court was, even where you have drugs that have not been bought or sold, never entered into any stream of commerce, and in fact there was no legitimate stream of commerce for this product, can congressional authority allow the enforcement of drug laws against individuals in this kind of circumstance? And the Supreme Court said yes, that Congress did have this authority under the Commerce Clause. So the commerce powers that Congress have are currently seen as being pretty expansive. What the individual health insurance mandate would do, though, is bring about a completely unique question in American law, and that is, does Congress's authority to regulate interstate commerce permit them to compel individual citizens to engage in commerce? Because essentially what we have at present is several million Americans, many of whom have voluntarily made a choice not to obtain health insurance. And so essentially, in order to prevail, Congress will have to demonstrate to the court that the power to regulate commerce means the power to force individuals to engage in commerce, and in fact, to purchase a particular product, even if the citizen does not want that product. That, as I mentioned, is a utterly unique question in American law. The court has never dealt with it, so it's difficult to say exactly how they'll come out. My best guess is that the four conservative justices on the court will almost certainly vote against an individual health insurance mandate, and the four justices who lean to the left will probably vote for it. It'll probably come down to Justice Anthony Kennedy, and his opinion will determine whether Congress actually has that kind of authority or not. Even if the court says that Congress has this authority to impose an individual health insurance mandate generally, remains a question whether the enforcement of such a law would be permissible under the Bill of Rights. As you're aware, the Bill of Rights establishes certain fundamental liberties for all Americans into which the government is not allowed to intrude. There are certain rights that I think are implicated by an individual health insurance mandate, among them the freedom of contract, the freedom of association, the right to privacy. All of these are implicated by an individual health insurance mandate. One thing we know about the right to contract, it's been acknowledged by the Supreme Court ever since 1798. One of the very first major cases handed down by the court was called Calder versus Bull, and they acknowledged that there is a freedom of contract. That was interpreted fairly expansively up until the mid-1930s, at which time the court dramatically decreased the protections for that particular right. And so right now, the freedom of contract is not highly regarded by the court. It's possible that they'll change their tune on that. At present, though, that's not likely to be a barrier to an individual health insurance mandate. The freedom of association offers a little bit more protection. It's possible that the court will find that an individual health insurance mandate would impermissibly violate the freedom of association. And then I think the really interesting question from the perspective of federal protections of liberty is the privacy question. We do know that two of the more conservative justices, Thomas and Scalia, have said that they don't believe that a federal right of privacy exists. But on the other hand, some of the more liberal justices have said emphatically there is a right to privacy and it is expansive. So if that question was put in front of the court, does the right to privacy protect a citizen from being forced to disclose information about their health, forced to go out and discuss these things with someone against their will? It's possible that you'd actually see a different majority finding against the enforcement of this mandate, with potentially a couple of the more liberal justices voting against the mandate, and then Thomas and Scalia voting that the right to privacy doesn't exist. So that's all the federal issues, and that gets us to a discussion of the bill that you guys are considering right now. The Healthcare Freedom Act essentially would establish a right protected under the state constitution. Now, one of the things that we know about constitutionalism in the United States is that the federal constitution creates kind of a floor, a baseline of liberty, and state constitutions are not allowed to afford fewer rights than those enshrined in the federal constitution. They are allowed to afford greater rights than those enshrined in the federal constitution. And so essentially that's what the Healthcare Freedom Act would do. It would create a state constitutional freedom. And then the question that would remain is, to what extent can it be enforced? I know that several weeks ago, at least one newspaper article ran that questioned whether the Healthcare Freedom Act could itself be considered unconstitutional. The answer to that is absolutely not. There's nothing that would prohibit a state like Missouri from adopting additional freedoms. Again, the real question is, how those freedoms would be enforced against the federal government. The answer to that is it's very difficult to know. The constitutional principle at play with that question is the Supremacy Clause, Article 6 of the Federal Constitution. And the Supremacy Clause says, in essence, that federal laws and constitution and treaties will always be superior to state laws and constitutional provisions. So that's what the plain text says. If you look at history, it's not exactly clear precisely what that means. Again, back in the earliest days of the Republic, there was a set of laws that Congress passed called the Alien and Sedition Acts. They were highly controversial. They basically criminalized criticizing certain public officials. And many people were outraged at what they perceived to be a violation of the First Amendment. And James Madison, the father of the Constitution, and Thomas Jefferson, the sitting vice president and the author of the Declaration of Independence, worked with the Kentucky and the Virginia legislatures to pass what were called the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions. And these essentially called into question the constitutionality of the Alien and Sedition Acts. The implication was that states had a voice in whether any particular statute was itself constitutional. For the next several decades, there was an undercurrent where there was this idea that states could, in fact, question the legitimacy of certain congressional laws. That was never put to a test in the Supreme Court. And in fact, some of the founders thought that kind of right to nullify federal laws was more extensive than others did. So it's unclear precisely how the Supreme Court would evaluate a supremacy argument based on the theory that states can essentially nullify federal laws that they believe to be unconstitutional.
We've got some questions that the committee has of you, if we can move on to some of those questions.
Yes, sir.
Senator Lemke.
David, thanks for your testimony. Riveting. We very rarely get a constitutional attorney here in the Capitol. So
well, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. So expand just briefly, and I think you might have been just getting there, but the idea of the Supremacy Clause and its proper use within its context, you know, in the Constitution, would the Supremacy Clause apply to anything outside the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution?
Yes, I believe so. It's possible. It's difficult to tell again because the enumerated powers that Congress have. You assume if we're getting to the Supremacy Clause question that the court has already decided that you're dealing with an enumerated power. Kind of the question that I think the courts are going to have to ask when it comes to this health insurance mandate is, does it fit in the commerce power or the tax power? And if they have already resolved that, saying, yes, we think it does, then presumably the question is already answered for the purposes of the Supremacy Clause and the 10th Amendment, both of which you know, define relationships between the states and the federal government. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, so maybe the question then is to get back to the idea that this is a unique situation that the federal government would be mandating somebody to consume a product.
That's right? Absolutely unique. And when the courts are resolving that issue, I think that'll be resolved within the context of the Commerce Clause. I don't think they'll get to the supremacy question with that particular issue. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. So the way that you look at Senator Cunningham's legislation, this certainly is just broadening then, again, the idea of enhancing the freedoms and liberties of Missourians, and not taking that opportunity or choice away if the federal government does pass something, as you read the legislation.
I believe that's accurate. As I read the amendment as it's currently written, I don't believe that it would nullify the federal law. I think it would simply say that the penalties that go along with the federal law, and to answer a question that was raised by Senator Days a little bit earlier, I think that the penalties that they currently are discussing is first a financial penalty that would be enforced via the IRS. If someone chose not to pay the financial penalty that was imposed against them, then potentially they could be incarcerated for failure to pay the financial penalty. So I believe that that's how you get to the potential for jail time for choosing to violate this law. If enforced, I believe that this state constitutional provision would block enforcement of those penalties against Missouri citizens who chose not to comply. And again, that would be the question that the court would be called upon to answer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Senator Days?
Thank you. Thank you for, so would this similar to if you don't pay your the IRS, you don't pay those taxes, you go to prison as well, right?
That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
The definition, thank you, the definition of commerce, has it been expanded or the federal government have a different definition of commerce? Because according to my Webster's dictionary, it deals with merchandise, trade on a large scale. So is medical services considered merchandise? Or
that gets to the original question of the original meaning of the Commerce Clause. I do believe that the original meaning of the Commerce Clause was significantly narrower than the court currently interprets it. The original meaning of the Commerce Clause, essentially, the Commerce Clause was adopted to prevent balkanization of the states. Under the Articles of Confederation, states were allowed to put up tariffs against imports from other states and to specially advantage their own economy against the interests of other states. That wasn't working under the Articles of Confederation. And so when the founders created the Constitution under which we currently operate, they said Congress needs to have the sole right to regulate interstate commerce to prevent this kind of trade war from popping up between the states. And so I believe the original intent very clearly referred to goods crossing state lines and whether you could make it more difficult for that to happen. The court in the last century or so, however, has interpreted commerce much more broadly to where now if they believe that something, any action or behavior impacts the stream of commerce, it doesn't even have to, as we saw in the medical marijuana case I referenced, it doesn't even actually have to be any particular form of commerce. As long as they believe that it has some impact on the stream of commerce, courts have given Congress the authority to go ahead and act via federal statute.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. All right, we're going to move on. Does anyone here want to speak in opposition? You want to come on up? If we have some more time, we'll come back to the pros.
This is a copy of his. I'll just give it to you.
Okay.
My name is Wayne Lee, disability advocate, and the reason that I approach is to merely go ahead and discuss just this piece of legislation with you, and any questions that you want to ask me, you can. First paragraph I want to read, then I'll let you have the rest of it. I have plenty of copies for everybody. Is it the principle, whatever that may be? Is the color gray appreciated more than blue? Could this be an attempt to prove that I am right and you are wrong, or, in all honesty, might it be fear of change? This advocate has yet to figure out the reason for this resistance being shown, or at least wonders if it just might be the fear of change. Change is a scary option for most people because there are risks that follow. But there's one thing for sure. Of the people that are insured in this country, 53.4% get that insurance from their employers where they work. 12% get it through Medicare, 13% through Medicaid, and then there comes 21% remaining. The others, some go and purchase it from a private health care insurance provider. Others don't have the money to buy it in the first place. It's either buy the food or starve to death and have health insurance. Then there are people like myself who have pre-existing conditions that couldn't get health care from a private company if we begged for it. Unless we want to pay a fortune, which we don't have. You are living on a six-figure income. You could make it. But the lower incomes, you're not going to get very much health insurance. The health insurance plan presented by the president, suggested anyway by him, and the five bills, three in the House and two in the Senate that started, ended up with one bill coming out of the House, followed by a bill coming out of the Senate. The bill in the House, as I understood it, had nothing to do with anybody being forced to purchase health care. It was public option. Insurance exchange is what is in the House, the Senate bill, pardon me. And the Senate bill is not something that is going to send anybody to jail that I knew anything about, although I might get better health care coverage in jail. I can tell you this. I don't recall anything in any of those pages that I read of those bills, and finally the one that did come out, that said anything about a person being forced to go to jail if they didn't pay their penalty or their fine. But then I don't know why anybody wouldn't want health care insurance in the first place. That's what shocks me. about this or any other bill. Why do people want to not get health care insurance? And one final point, and then I'll finish. And that is this. Nobody is being forced by these bills, either the House or the Senate bill, to not go ahead and continue purchasing health care where they are currently purchasing it. They can go ahead and see the same doctor they want to see. There's nothing in those bills that suggests otherwise. But I don't understand the reasoning for this bill or the meaning of it. But
okay, thank you. Questions for this witness? Senator Lemke.
Thank you. Mr. Lee, I think you make a pretty good point. We don't have any finalized bill, right, from Washington,
no
D.C.
There's
a number of bills that are going around. So whatever that final product is, do you foresee that what Senator Cunningham is introducing here would impede from any Missourian from accessing whatever the final product is out of Washington, D.C.?
No, I don't foresee that. What I don't...
I don't understand why you're testifying against the bill, then.
I'm testifying against the bill because I don't see the point of it. Why?
The point is to afford Missourians more freedom.
They're not going to be denied that freedom in the first place. Did you not hear my last comment?
Well, no, what I did hear is we don't know what the final product out of Washington, D.C. is.
We may not know what the final product is, but neither the House nor the Senate bill suggest that a person is not going to be able to purchase their own.
Well, I think they do suggest it. And I think that that's something that's been part of the conversation and why the people not only of Missouri but of this country are fourscore against this coming out of Washington, D.C. We don't have a final product. All we're trying to do with this bill is address the freedoms of Missourians as far as their access to care.
And access to care is not denied, to my knowledge, in those bills. And I'll have to check with my colleagues with the Disability Coalition for Healthcare Reform, which has been around for a long time, that organization. And I don't recall hearing a word from them, a word from any other organization working to see healthcare reform so that persons with disabilities, persons on low income, can go ahead and get health insurance. But this bill, be that as it may, I don't think it will have much standing anyway once a federal bill is passed, because unless it goes beyond what the federal government offers, and I heard Senator Cunningham making that statement. But this is not going beyond, as I see it. What it's doing is going ahead and just saying the very same thing that are in both Senate and House bills. If somebody can point out the very location for me, I'll go ahead and read that section again and see if I just misinterpreted it, and go ahead and get my colleagues to do the same.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Anyone else here to speak in opposition?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Landon. I'm here representing the Missouri Hospital Association. There have been a lot of interesting questions about laws and rights relating to this matter and state sovereignty. Those are all interesting questions. It's not the question that I'm here to talk about. The question I'm here to talk about is somewhat how the rubber might well meet the road. The bills that are pending in Congress, although the momentum on that has certainly changed recently, each of them extracts a very large amount of money from hospitals in terms of reductions to Medicaid disproportionate share hospital payments, and especially Medicare payments to fund this program. Nationally, it's about $150 billion with a B, from hospitals to fund the cost of this. Our concern is that if that money goes to the federal, if this something like this were to pass, that money would go to the federal government, and ostensibly it would be used to cover more people. So we have money going out away from us, but we would get it back in terms of more people being covered. The main, or at least one of the main ways that the federal government can cover more people, is to have an individual mandate or a mandate to have coverage. If that is not enforceable in Missouri, there will be some, and I don't know how many, people who do not get coverage. Our money from hospitals has gone to Washington, and it's not coming back. It will go to other states. It will go to whatever they do with it in Washington, but it's probably not coming back here if there's not a way, if there's not an ability to mandate that people have coverage. So our concern essentially is that these two things together, and we understand state legislators have an enormous amount of information to process. You might not be aware that specifically in the federal government, in each of these 2,000-page bills apiece in the Senate and House, they take an enormous amount of hospital money, and we are worried that this money will not be able to come back into Missouri if the federal government's ability to enforce some sort of mandate or to essentially say that the people of Missouri need to have coverage, it won't be coming back here. We'll essentially be shipping money out, and it won't be coming back. That's the gist of my comments as to how the bill makes us have some concern, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Landon. Senator Days?
Mr. Landon, right now across your all of your hospitals, about what's the average percentage of your uncompensated care right now? Do you have any idea?
The average percentage of
uncompensated care. These are people who come to your hospitals, and they do not have insurance, but you are required to treat them at some level. Do you have any idea?
Off the top of my head, I can get you a number pretty quickly, but off the top of my head, I'm not sure.
And I was wondering how would this affect that? How would this bill affect your uncompensated care in the various hospitals?
This bill of itself, probably not so much. I think what we're looking at is the fact that the federal bill is designed to reduce the amount of uncompensated care. It takes money away from us, and it would cover more people.
But it would cover other people, other places. It would cover other people, other places, and not Missouri. Is that not what I
think the gist of my comments is Missouri hospital money will be going to Washington.
Okay.
If there is not an ability to enforce a mandate here, if this goes through the courts and is upheld and everything, there's not an ability to enforce a mandate here, our concern is some unknown number of people will not get coverage here, and they will still show up at our emergency rooms as uninsured.
That's my
money will have gone somewhere else, and it won't be coming back.
Senator Schaefer?
Actually, I just had a comment. I don't even know that you can assume that the money that goes from the hospitals to Washington will be spent on health care. It could be spent on pretty much anything. So
That's true.
Right. So that's just an assumption. Thanks. Right.
Senator Lemke?
Mr. Landon, it seems to me that your concern or the hospital association's concern is tied to the fact that many, many decades ago your industry decided to get in bed with the federal government, and now your industry has their tail between their legs because the federal government wants to further, intrude into your industry and the providing of health care to Missourians and citizens of this great country. And as they further mess up the system, you have to testify against a bill that is trying to afford more freedom to our citizens in Missouri and throw around numbers that you don't know, again, what the final product is. Your association dropped a memo before this hearing saying that, we're going to lose billions of dollars in Missouri. And again, I think that it's a travesty that the hospital association won't stand up to this thing. Our docs, our providers are standing up with us on this bill saying this is not the purview of the federal government and they should not be trying to dictate this to Missourians and the rest of the citizens of this country. So I'm really disappointed in the hospital association. I wish that you guys would have taken a neutral stand to see how this thing plays out at the federal level when elected officials in Missouri are just trying to protect their citizens. So, thank you.
Senator Schumacher.
Just to follow up on that, Daniel. What's your job? What are you supposed to do every day when you come over to Capitol? Are you supposed to protect the interest of the people that pay you a salary, the hospitals? Are you supposed to protect their interests the best that you see how?
I believe so.
And over the next 10 years, it was projected that there's a good possibility that you'd lose, over $2 billion, very likely?
the savings extracted, and I think it's fair to say we're not positing that the $2.5 billion that's posited to be taken out of Missouri hospitals over the next 10 years, these are all 10-year functions, they're not going to be all out the window because of this bill. But
right.
Some of those people will not be able to be covered. But, yeah, and we worked with the accounting firm of BKD to analyze hospital cost reports. So the $2.5 billion figure isn't something we figured out on the back of a napkin.
Okay. Well, and I guess and that's part of it. So, I mean, if we walk through if this passes or it doesn't pass, I would presume there's some huge interests that probably will take litigation at some point in time that will be costly not only to the state and to those interested parties. Would that be a correct or fair assumption, I guess I should say?
Well, the previous gentleman who spoke very eloquently about the constitutional issues, I think those will be resolved, as he mentioned, in the Supreme Court, and it'll be a 5-4 decision either way.
And I appreciate those constitutional discussions. Those are things we should we've defended with a lot of bloodshed and lives and people and you know it's a bedrock. But there are also your job, and you know, and whether I agree with the folks coming up here sitting in front of me or not, I think we should all recognize that you have a job to do. And you're sitting there in front of us doing your job that you believe will enhance the interest of the hospitals within the state of Missouri. I do appreciate that, but I guess the other thing is, what do you see on the other side of the FRA tax? Is this part of that $2.5 billion? Is that part of the FRA tax that you all send out to D.C. to draw down federal dollars now, or is this other dollars that we're talking about?
Indirectly. Most of the $2.5 billion comes from Medicare, which has nothing to do with Jeff City.
Okay, so that's your reimbursement.
Okay. Medicaid, some of that money is reductions in disproportionate share hospital payments. The state share of those payments are funded by the provider tax. So
okay.
That money will go down. The provider tax won't be needed to fund them.
Okay. Well, I just want to get out that there, you know, while these liberties are really important for us to watch, there are also other interests that we should be mindful of in this discussion. And certainly, even though it's very easy to change the dialogue of the discussion, I don't know a Democrat or Republican that doesn't run out that will raise their hand and say we believe in freedom anywhere in this state, anywhere. But the realities are the realities are the policies that we pass have long term implications for a whole variety of issues and what's a sometimes as a freedom to somebody else is a real binding effect on someone else. So we have to be mindful of all those freedoms of everyone. So that's enough flowery comment. Thank you.
Thank you. I got an example from that when we heard the last health care bill 2 weeks ago here in this room on the federal mandate. You know, I come from an area that tends to be a little thrifty, and what we look at is when I look at legislation, I look at how people are going to get around it, because that's exactly what happens, because what looks good on paper doesn't necessarily translate into good legislation when the rubber meets the road. My recollection that if you do not buy health insurance, that you'll pay a $95 a year up to $750 a year fine. Is that
recollection in the House bill, I believe.
Okay, then you make the choice to buy insurance or pay the fine. Now, when you require insurance companies, it was my understanding that you require insurance companies not to do pre-existing conditions and guaranteed issuance. What stops me from just simply not buying the insurance, paying the $95 a year up to $750 a year fine? Then when I need insurance, since I can't be disqualified for pre-existing conditions and guaranteed issuance, then going down and buying a policy, what about that scenario won't work, or can an individual operate under the system that way?
My understanding of these 2,000-page federal bills is that, yes, indeed, you could do that, and it's a matter of grave concern in designing them, because if you don't set the penalty right, you will have people do just that. they will wait until they get sick to buy health insurance, which is like buying fire insurance on a burning house. That's not the way you want to run the
system. So you, the Hospital Association would like to see higher fines on people not to buy insurance. Because you get to a point where you're going to have the fine up higher than it is to buy an insurance policy. Otherwise, you're going to have that scenario. Under the legislation that I saw, I can pay $95 fine, go without insurance, and then when I get sick, I can go buy insurance.
Right.
Now, how are you going to stop that system? And, you know, you're defeating your whole purpose when you're able to do that. So I don't understand it. Because I see exactly, I see that's what's happening. You're still going to have people come in without insurance, and they're going to go down and buy insurance.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on the premise. I think the key question that they're debating in Congress is what should those fines be?
Well, the legislation I saw was $95 up to $750. And $750 a year to pay a fine and then go buy my insurance, you're going to have people do that all over the place. I don't understand what you're accomplishing.
My recollection is the Senate bill, individual penalties are higher. So,
all right.
I think it's a matter of discussion and
conference. Further questions? Senator Lager.
A statement of caution. And I'm not faulting you. I actually agree with Wes. You're here doing your job, and I appreciate that. I just think what this underscores for me is the caution that needs to happen, whether it's here or in Washington, that we do not continue to allow our freedoms to be eroded for the bottom lines of companies. And we often penalize insurance companies, and I understand that you guys have to stay in business as well, but it's a very delicate balance. And so I just hope we're all cautious of that as we move forward. And I understand why you're here and, you know, taking the position you have. But I understand that many of us also believe that we have a fundamental response. We know we have a fundamental responsibility to defend those freedoms and everything that those people sent us here to do. So thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Daniel, for your testimony. Anyone else here to speak in opposition? Okay, if no one else speak in opposition, you've got 10 more minutes to bring up.
Okay. Dr. Jeffrey Thomason, he is with West County Radiology in St. Louis.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, senators. Thank you for allowing me to speak. For the record, my name is Jeff Thomason. I'm a neuroradiologist at St. John's Mercy Medical Center in St. Louis. That's a level one trauma center in St. Louis County. I'm immediate past president of the Missouri State Medical Association. I'm president of West County Radiology Group, which services both St. John's and St. Louis and in Washington, Missouri. And I'm also clinical assistant professor of diagnostic radiology at St. Louis University. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of the Healthcare Freedom Act. As you all may know, the Missouri State Medical Association voted last year to oppose Senate Bill 3590. And I'm pleased to announce today that over this past weekend, the Missouri State Medical Association Council voted to support the Healthcare Freedom Act that is being heard today. It is a fundamental right of everyone to make healthcare decisions, and that freedom is right up there with how we worship, where we worship, where we go to school, where we buy groceries, et cetera. And it is the duty of our elected officials to protect us as part of their service. Which doctor or which hospital person goes to should be their own choice. Now, you may sign up for an insurance policy that says your doctor is out of network or that hospital won't let you do that, but there's no law against saying, well, I'm going to pay my own money and go someplace else because I believe the services are better there or because the parking is better or because the view is better or whatever. And that applies to both elective procedures when a person is healthy and getting things taken care of in an orderly fashion, or if they are speeding their kid to the nearest ER to get them sewn up, or they're having some catastrophic medical illness. And it is at these times when patients are most vulnerable
and certainly need all the protection they can get from harmful government mandates. And this legislation is in response to people in our state and in other states who perceive that there are bills out there, the three that have already been discussed, future legislation, which may hamper their freedom. And it is important to have something on the books to prevent that from damaging patients. And I'll tell you a personal example from my own life. My father semi-retired in 1993, was still working. He stopped doing surgery. He was a general surgeon, but he was doing some industrial medicine, seeing folks at the state sanitarium for surgical consultations. And on a bright November morning, started having facial twitching. Well, it turned out it was a focal seizure. I raced over to my folks' house. My mom's a doc, too. And it was like, Dad, you got a focal seizure. We got to take care of this. Where do you want to go? Now, he was on staff at a number of hospitals in St. Louis. He chose to go to my hospital. I'm a neuroradiologist, but the quality of neuroscience care is particularly great at St. John's Mercy Medical Center. So that's where we took him, and that's where his neurosurgeon was, his neurologist. Unfortunately, it was an inoperable, highly malignant brain tumor. And 8 months later, he was dead. As part of that transition, we had the wonderful saint-like hospice nurses from St. John's. He stayed at home. He didn't want to go into a hospice, so we were able to keep my dad home. And it was a situation where his dignity was preserved and everything. So there was no government mandate about end-of-life counseling or blue pill, red pill, anything like that. So I would ask you all, when you are thinking about what your constituents are going to do about their health care, think about your own experiences in life, where you had your baby, what nursing home your mom's in, and bear that in mind. We want to preserve that freedom for all your constituents in this great state. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Schaefer?
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. I don't know if you knew my dad. My dad was a surgeon at Dr. Glenn Schaefer at St. John's Hospital.
Wow, sure. Yeah,
in the surgery department. You know, my dad died 2 years ago as well, received care at the end of his life at St. John's. But, you know, I think about he died before I came into the Senate, and I try and think about what advice he would give, because I grew up with somebody who graduated from medical school in the 1950s, was, you know, chief resident at City Hospital in St. Louis before going into private practice at St. John's in 1962 when it was still at the old location. You know, moved to the new hospital, helped build that hospital. And, you know, thinking in the 1970s especially, when, you know, he had an enormous solo practice, I think half of his patients didn't pay him. But, you know, those that could pay did. It was a type of medicine that doesn't exist anymore. But I think the issue of hearing from the doctors, to me, because I will tell you, as a trial lawyer, when I'm putting on a case, I try and find an expert in the field that I'm dealing with. And so when we're talking about healthcare, we have got to hear from the doctors. We have to hear from the people who provide the service. And I believe that medical service still is a commodity. It's something that you train for, you go into the profession, and then you decide what you're going to contract for the compensation that you get for what you provide. And different doctors have different attitudes on that, and some get paid more and some get paid less. Those are decisions they make, and I think that should be a decision between them and their patients. And I think that what we're looking at now, and I got here a little bit late and I missed the gentleman who provided some of the constitutional testimony, but I hope that everybody fully appreciates the level of the unprecedented move by the federal government to mandate every citizen in Missouri and in this country to buy a product in the private sector. It is an unprecedented takeover. I'm an environmental lawyer. All environmental laws, federal laws, stem from the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 3. And there's 200 years worth of U.S. Supreme Court precedent on what the word commerce means. And you get into the broadest context and straining credulity on what that means in the environmental context. Because ever since the late 1960s, early 1970s, when the federal government got into the business of environmental regulation, and truly, I think it was the right thing for them to do, because just as you don't want balkanization between commerce of states, you also have environmental issues that transfer between states. You know, air pollution doesn't stop at a state boundary. But you look at the way that precedent has gone, and you look at the new door that the Congress is about to open. And if you're someone like me, who for 15 years has been looking at those Supreme Court decisions and advising clients and deciding in my capacity as a senator where things are going, we have no idea once this door is opened where it could go. We got a pretty good idea when you look at that precedent of how broad that will get. But again, I really appreciate the doctors stepping up on this, because I think more than anyone, the doctors are who we need to hear from. And so I thank you for your testimony here today.
Senator Days, you have a quick question? Our time's up on this.
I'll see how quick it's going to be. Doctor, thank you very much for your testimony. However, I'm hearing you speak of people who have the means of which to access your care, the doctors and the lawyers, it's in the families, these people who have means of having that kind of choice. Now, I want to flip the script a little bit for those who do not have that opportunity, or they do not have the resources that perhaps your neighborhood and your family does. And I'm trying to figure out how that works on the other end. I do have coverage through the state and whatever that means. However, I am allowed to attend or to go to physicians who accept the kind of insurance that's provided here by my employer. And that I'm trying to understand your situation and how that affects the other people. I had a very good physician. She no longer took this insurance that we have. So I had to find another physician that did that. And so I'm trying to look at what my freedoms were. I could have attended that same physician, but I would have had to pay an extremely high amount of money that I did not have. And so I'm trying to figure out how you approach that with, I guess, these patients that cannot afford, you know, what you're talking about here.
Well, Senator, you bring up a number of vital issues. First of all, I'm going to have to confess that I am the place where I work is a level one trauma center, one of three in eastern Missouri. And if you come to our door, you will get care that is through the emergency room, mm-hmm. regardless of your means. That's about.
Right. I think that's everybody. I think that's everybody now.
Law. That's right. About the last thing. The other thing, which St. John's is famous for, is providing care for folks who speak Spanish as their primary language and may or may not be in the country with appropriate authorization, and do not have the means. There is also a clinic system at St. John's. And so, yes, all of us do face issues with which doctor we can or can't see. And I would turn that or give another perspective on that. Our group tries to be with as many insurance companies as possible so that we are all on the same page as the hospital, so mm-hmm. that someone comes into the hospital, we can take care of them. And I would say that it behooves physicians to accept as many insurances as they absolutely can. Insurance companies, on the other hand, make that a daunting task from yearly credentialing. And instead of filling out one form that goes to all of them, we got to fill out this one, this one, this one, this one. And so, you know, you can't get all of them, but, we try to do as many as possible. And it is unfortunate when your doctor is out of network. And
thank you, Doctor. We're going to have to move on. We're going to end the hearing on SJR 25. If you did not get a chance to testify, we will take written testimony, and you're able to talk with members of the committee. And everyone that's appeared needs to do a witness form. So thank you very much, Senator Cunningham.